Man, that song just cracks me up every time I hear it. The Bob Lazar song, I think it's a one-man band, a guy named Arthur Unknown, and he's got a music video he produced that goes with it. We posted it on the Coast website if you want to take a look at it. That's a lot of fun. It's one of dozens of songs that have been written about Area 51 since Bob's story came out. Coming up in this hour, we're going to talk a little bit about Element 115, which Bob says powers these craft. We'll talk about why he went public with his story, how it led to death threats and all kinds of trouble for he and friends like Gene Huff. And then we might have a surprise guest call in to join the conversation. Much, much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, we're into the heart of the story right now. And Gene Huff, I'm going to jump out of order. We'll come back to Bob and Element 115 in a moment. Bob just described before the break seeing this test flight of the sport model over off of Papoose Lake, and it flew up a couple of feet. You also saw a test flight of what appeared to have been the sport model. It was from a long way away. Actually, you saw a couple of them. Jumping out of chronological order, tell me about the experience of being out in the desert with Bob after he had told you about these test flights and you seeing one for yourself.
Well, Bob took me and his ex-wife Tracy and who else the first time? I guess John Lear. John Lear.
Well, John Lear, right?
Yeah. Yeah, we went out there in John Lear's RV, and Bob knew that the test flights were supposed to happen just after dark on Wednesday nights because it's in the middle of the week, in the middle of nowhere, and just basic logic dictates that there wouldn't you wouldn't have problems with any onlookers. And we went out there, and shortly after dark, we were scanning the mountainside, and suddenly a light popped up above the mountain range and just sat still. And I told Bob that I thought that that light just popped up there, and he said he thought it was the planet Sirius, and he had binoculars and he was looking around the other way.
Planet Sirius.
Or the star.
Excuse me, the star Sirius.
Okay.
And then he looked another direction. I said, "Hey, Bob, Sirius just jumped about 5 miles to the right." And he looked up, and that's when we started seeing this disc actually go through its motions of step moves up in the sky. It would stop and glow a little brightly and then jump to another location. And on the night we saw got the best look at it, it was actually coming down the Groom Mountain Range toward us, and it was a peculiar mode of travel to your brain. We're used to seeing cars on a highway or trains on a railroad track or whatever, a light or an object at a certain speed moving toward us, and I guess our brain triangulates that and calculates how far we are from it and whether we're safe or not. Well, with a flying disc, it doesn't travel in a linear mode like that. You'd be looking at it and you blink, and then suddenly it's a few miles closer to you. And then without noticing it happening again, suddenly it's closer to you yet. And then you blink again and it jumps. And this is alarming to your mind's eye because you didn't see it travel towards you, but suddenly it's upon you. And then it got so close one time it glowed. And Bob can explain why it does this, but it glowed very brightly. So to us, it looked like it was going to explode. We backed up behind the trunk lid of the car, and then it glowed back down and flew back over, back down around the mountain range and went back behind the mountain and hovered for a minute and just popped down just like it popped up. And
I should point out there were trips out there, 3 of these trips, 3 weeks in a row, in which multiple witnesses saw these things flying out there. You recorded some video, and I mentioned that at the beginning of the show program. We're trying to post something that's an enhancement of that. But, Gene, for you, you're Bob's friend. You've got to know him really well. Some really strange stuff had happened to the two of you that we'll get into later. But at some point, you had to be wondering, is this guy telling me the truth? And then he takes you out in the desert, and lo and behold, there's a test of what looks like a saucer right in the spot where he said it would be.
Well, he's not much of a joker. I didn't really suspect that he was lying prior to that, but of course you want to see some proof. In fact, I was telling him after I found out that he was in the program, what he was doing, I started reading all kinds of UFO information, about the Roswell crash in the 40s and the Russian sightings in the 50s and all these things. And I said, if all that was happening then there must be something going on somewhere right now, and that's where I want to be. And he said, "What are you doing on Wednesday night?"
That's
why I didn't go out there with him.
And you, I mean, but wow, seeing it and having it confirmed, it must have been sort of like Bob's moment of clarity when it all comes crashing down on his head. Oh my gosh, this is real.
Yeah, it was exhilarating to me. I mean, I just I was fortunate enough to see a craft from another star system fly right out here in southern Nevada. It was an important moment of my life, probably second to the birth of my son, one of the most important moments of my life.
Well, it sort of goes back to what I was hinting at the beginning of the program. You know, Bob takes so much grief from ufologists and people outside of ufology. Well, where did he work and where did he go to school? And for me, you know, it's a matter of keeping your eye on the ball. Is the key for me are there flying saucers out there being tested in the desert? And that's the central question. And it seems to me that Bob knew a heck of a lot of stuff that he should not have known if he hadn't been out there. He knew about the test flights, when they would occur, where they would occur. He knew about the existence of a place called S4 that had never been made public. Some things we haven't got into. He knew about an agency called the OFI, Office of Federal Investigation, which did the background check on him. He knew about the name of the man who came to do the background check, a guy named Mike Thigpen, who we believe is still alive. All that was real. And you have to wonder, well, how did he know it if he wasn't in the program? Bob, I want to go back to, did you want to say something there?
Well, I just wanted to say, and it, you know, some people don't even think Bob worked at Area 51 or S4. So and Mike Thigpen of the OFI, which is the Office of Federal Investigation, which is the Office of Personnel Management out of Pennsylvania. What was Mike Thigpen doing at Bob's house? He was witnessed there by Shelley Ball, I think, and certainly by Tracy, Bob's ex-wife. They saw this man and another man come, you know, go through Bob's papers and belongings and, you know, his entire house just to see what he's got and what he's up to. Now, if Bob wasn't in a secret project, what were these guys doing coming to his house in the middle of the night?
Let's go back to the technology and the power source, Element 115. At the time that, Bob, you first told me this story and told it to others, Element 115 did not exist. It exists now. It's been synthesized in a different form. Tell me about what this stuff is, what its physical properties are, and why you think it came from somewhere else.
Well, it's a super heavy element. And by that, I mean, you know, on the periodic chart of the elements, uranium is about the, you know, 92 on the periodic chart is about the highest you can naturally find. Now there are, for nitpickers, there are trace amounts of plutonium that have been found in the Earth's crust, you know, formed by natural nuclear reactors. But, you know, for the most part, that's everything higher than that has to be synthesized. Now, it's not like we can make quantities of this stuff. We just make a few atoms and, you know, accelerators or that's about the only way to make them. Just enough atoms to verify their existence and see how long their half-lives are. So when there is a large quantity, you know, a measurable quantity of a super heavy element, way higher than anything that we've synthesized, you know, you have to question its origins. Now, this was apparently the fuel that was part of the, you know, that powered the reactor, part of an alien craft. So, is it possible that they have some advanced technology to synthesize it? Probably, but more likely, where they're from has naturally occurring heavier elements. Now, I don't know that for a fact, but it's not impossible. The star system they come from is a binary star system, and, you know, different chemistry might have taken place there. But in either case, we identified the element as best we could to point to element 115. You know, we used various methods from neutron activation and, you know, atomic absorption spectroscopy and atomic fluorescence spectroscopy. And, you know, it was something that we had never seen before, that apparently had some amazing properties to it, that when it operated in the reactor, it produced a gravitational field due to actions in that reactor. So the gravitational field is focused and channeled through waveguides, much like microwaves are, and these are folded around the craft and routed down to the amplifiers and emitters down below, which is how the craft is powered. Now, unlike all the flying machines that humans have made, they all work under the action-reaction principle. In other words, a rocket or a jet or an airplane always takes gas, either air or combustion products, and accelerates it out the back of the craft, which pushes it forward. The way the discs work is they take and focus a gravitational distortion in front of the craft, and the craft essentially falls forward. That's a weird thing to envision, but what an easy way, my analogy is if you put a bowling ball in the middle of your bed and then a foot in front of it, you push down with your fist, the bowling ball rolls towards your fist. That's how the crafts operate, which is really unusual compared to the way we're used to powering things. It's kind of an unstable flight in the low power mode, which is essentially, you know, flying around at low speed. In space, it operates in a different fashion, but still using the gravitational propulsion.
So if you're an alien and you're on a planet circling one of the Zeta Reticuli stars and you want to go to Earth, you point this thing at Earth and sort of pull it toward you.
Kind of. You bend space with it. In the two different modes were called Omicron and Delta configurations. In Omicron mode, it uses one of the gravity amplifiers to create a small distortion from the craft, and it moves forward at low speed. In Delta mode, the craft faces its belly toward the destination. All three amplifiers come to power, and they converge on a point. Now, it can only go so far. I don't know how far each jump is, but it's a tremendous distance. That point is essentially pulled to the craft, and it snaps virtually instantaneously, because remember, we're dealing with gravitational propulsion, and gravity and time are intertwined, so virtually no time passes, and it's flying outside normal space. It's something that's not easy to conceive at all, but this is in fact how the craft operates. Now, it does these, there's a recycle time on the generators. It can't do it, make these jumps instantaneously, but it has to make several of them to go to any great distance.
Obviously, there's great weapons potential for Element 115. You had told me about it the first time we talked. If you wanted to make a bomb out of this stuff, it'd be one heck of a bomb, because it's like a total annihilation reaction.
Yeah, exactly. The weapon potential of the craft, you know, a lot of people say, well, let's just assume all this stuff is true. Why in the world do they keep this stuff, you know, quiet? Why is it so secret? I mean, it almost always comes down to weapon potential. Now, I don't know if that's the only reason. You know, people aren't going to panic and start running in the streets if you tell them that we've had,
aliens.
Proof of contact, you know, with alien technology. They might get pissed off that you've been lying to them for 50 years about it. But, you know, nobody trusts the government anymore anyway. But, when it comes to weapons, you know, we really love our weapons when it comes to the United States. And that has some incredible potential, not just explosive power, but as Gene mentioned at the start of the show, if you control gravity, you can manipulate the flow of particles and, you know, things like beam weapons that can be focused and things that are just kind of out of the reach of our technology can really be brought under control using, you know, some of this technology.
Go ahead, Gene.
With the propulsion method you just described, so my description before of how the disc would appear to jump toward us and then jump further toward us, I guess it was creating a divot in front of it, and there would slide into that divot and then create another one. And these were what I perceived as jumps from my point of view.
Yeah, that's exactly what you saw. I mean, you're probably one of the few people on the planet that actually saw exactly what I was talking about firsthand.
Okay. At one point, Bob, you had a piece of this stuff, and the assumption has always been by people who follow the story, well, you must have stolen it from work, and they have a lot of trouble with it for a variety of reasons. You had said the when they use a slice of it, like a pizza, a little mini pizza-shaped piece of it into the reactor, that's how it works, and that they had 500 pounds of it. But at some point, you did have a piece of it outside of work. Can you describe, and one reason I know about it is because I was there one night when you did a test with it. I personally saw it. Can you describe how you got it, or can you get into details? You didn't steal it, did you?
You know, I'm just not going to touch on that subject there.
But you did have can you confirm you had a piece of it? You don't want to get into that either.
No, why would I want to do that?
All right. It doesn't behave how you predict that it would behave, the kind of 115 that's been synthesized, right?
The 115.
I think he's getting around to it's an isotope.
Okay. Oh, the 115 that
Yeah, that's
we
been
made.
Created in a lab by humans, yes.
Yeah, it's certainly 115, but yes, it doesn't behave like the material in the craft. It's, you know, it's an isotope of 115. Look, there's, you know, elements have isotopes. They're still the same element. For instance, hydrogen. We're all familiar with hydrogen. It's a lighter than air gas. It's flammable. Hydrogen has three isotopes, deuterium and tritium. One of them is radioactive and has I can't remember, a 12.5-year half-life, something like that. Deuterium is stable, and protium, which is regular hydrogen, is also stable. Now, the isotope they made, I don't recall what the half-life was on it, but, there again, it's an isotope of 115. If they continue experimenting, I'm sure they'll come up with other isotopes and inevitably, also produce the stable isotope that was in powering the craft. Now, again, they're producing atoms of it, so there's no chance they're going to produce a measurable quantity where they can start playing with this material in a useful manner. They'll just be able to identify some of the properties of it. So I don't really know where that research is going to go, other than one day they'll say, hey, we have a stable super heavy element here.
I mean, when you think about what you could do with an operating disk that can perform in the way that you describe, I mean, the military potential is beyond anything. It makes you wonder what they might be doing with it. Are they using it?
You can take over the world single-handedly with an operating disk. First of all, because it's a gravity distorted field around it, it can't be affected by projectiles or explosions. I mean, which is the basis of our weapons. So it's essentially invulnerable. Now, there could be electromagnetic means of disabling the craft. I don't know how one would stop one from working. But, you can shoot it at it all day long with tanks or drop bombs on it. It's just not going to be effective. So, yeah, weapon potential, it's staggering. And, our goal was essentially to see, can we duplicate this technology with the materials we have available to us? And at the time, the answer was a resounding no. 25 years have gone by. I don't know what progress they've made or where they're doing this anymore, but I really don't know what the answer is today.
But I guess the fact is, if you were to use it in a military sense, you would reveal its existence, and clearly they've shown no interest in that. The other questions it raises is, if aliens have this technology, you can imagine what they could do to us if they wanted to. We're going to take a short break with REM. A Stand is the name of the song. It brings us back to 1989. And when we come back, we're going to talk about some of the terrible consequences for Bob and Jean on a personal level once this story broke. Much more to come at Coast to Coast AM. That's a great song from 1989, gravel-voiced rock survivor Joe Cocker. When the Night Comes is the name of the tune. We were hoping to surprise you listeners with a visit from John Lear. John is a critical part of this story. crucial role he played in the Bob Lazar tale being made public. And, you know, we joke with John, and when I say crazy John Lear, I'm using air quotes because there are people in the public who don't buy any of this UFO stuff or any of John's stuff. But I can tell you, I owe John such a debt of gratitude, because when I first started chasing the UFO story and some of the Area 51 stuff, John was so gracious in sharing with me all of his files and material and explaining the who, what, and when and where of ufology. And it's a bizarre world with its own rules, and John helped me navigate it, and I can never repay him for that. And he got to know Bob Lazar and Gene Huff pretty well. It's a sometimes contentious relationship. The public has no idea how all those pieces fit together, but John has been really important to this story. We're going to talk a little bit about John Lear and the personal sacrifices that all of these guys made, because they were daunting, and there was intimidation and threats and some pretty nasty stuff that happened. And we're going to get into that when we come back here on Coast to Coast AM. We're back with Bob Lazar and Gene Huff. Gene, I want to ask you about John Lear. You know, there's a perception by people who don't want to believe this whole story that John Lear must have cooked it all up, that you guys went along with it and are having a chuckle at the public's expense, and you all speak with one voice. And I just have to laugh at it. I mean, you've gone round and round with John yourself, but in general, I think you agree he plays a key role in this whole story and how things unfolded.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, if there's one thing Bob Lazar loves to do, it's to rain on people's parade about their misperceptions about everything. You could tell Bob your name and he could explain why your name was wrong. And so, and nobody says more debatable things than John Lear. I mean, John throws some crazy things out there, but the bottom line is that when we met John Lear said that there had been life here from elsewhere. The American government knew about it and was hiding it. And, of course, that it has been around since antiquity. And in the past 25 years, I've read literally tens of thousands of pages of research. And the bottom line is John Lear was right. Life has been here. And, in fact, it's so much easier to determine a UFO sighting in antiquity, as you pointed out before, with the the U-2, the stealth fighter and bomber, the SR-71. Nowadays, there are definitely anomalies in the sky that you might not be able to distinguish between a UFO and just a flying object that you don't know, or an alien spacecraft. But 500 years ago, there was nothing metal flying around in the sky. So it was easy to determine, something that was not from around here back then. But the bottom line is, Lear did say there was life here from elsewhere. The government knew it. They hid it. And that was true. Now, he might say some other outrageous things, but the bottom line is what John asserted has proven to be true and has been accepted all the way up until, as you well know, the year before last, Dr. Edgar Mitchell, the Apollo astronaut and the sixth man to walk on the moon, went public and declared that he's 90% certain that life from elsewhere has been here and that the American government knows about it and has covered it up. And he knows this in his travels around the world from lay people as well as from contacts who have worked at the Pentagon in the past and still work at the Pentagon now, and saved 10% to the fact that maybe the whole world is playing a joke on him. But this is a big revelation. This isn't some UFO nut you could just poo-poo. This man has a degrees in aeronautics and astronautics. He's an American hero, and he says he's 90% sure this is real.
Bob, same sort of question to you about John. Let me ask it a different way. Why did you tell him what was going on, what you were working on? I mean, you'd said that when you had your first contacts with him, you told him you thought this whole UFO stuff was baloney. You didn't believe a bit of it. And then you find yourself in the unenviable position of finding out at least some of it really is real. And you decided to tell John Lear about it and Gene and others.
Well, John Lear was mainly because, at the time, it looked like this guy had spent his life researching this. I mean, all the files he had, and I mean, he knew every bit of information that can be had from all different sources and was trying so desperately to put this together. And look, he even told me what, was essentially true. As Gene mentioned, It's just like I wanted to confirm, you know, with him. Just look, this is what you thought. Now, and as Gene also mentioned, you know, John has a lot of other beliefs that, you know, I don't agree with. You know, for instance, he thinks people live inside the sun, among other, you know, bizarre things, you know, which to me is silly nonsense. But the thing is that, you know, when we first met John, he did have a surprising amount of information that, you know, according to what I was exposed to, you know, was correct. So at some point, John did run into somebody who actually had some real information.
We've talked to John on the air before. It's been a while, but and we wish him well. As we all know, in our group, John's got some health issues that he's been battling, and we had hoped he'd join us tonight, but we certainly understand why he wasn't up to it. But there came a time when you told him about this stuff, and you told Gene, and you told others. And I want to know, sort of walk us through that process, what the reasons were. I know public statements you made before is that security out there was omnipresent, just over the top. You felt that they were sort of squandering the opportunity, not making enough progress. And you also felt threatened. I mean, John made some real sacrifices to pursue this line of truth. So did you.
Yeah. You know, as time went on, I was there for a short while. And because of what was going on at the project, they really wanted me up to speed as quickly as possible. And, you know, boy, the story is kind of long, but to make it a shorter, when I fell out of favor with them, I began to be a little concerned. They wanted to review my security clearance, and I stopped getting called into work. And at this time, I began to worry that, boy, they're not just going to let somebody like me, after everything they've told me, you know, just go back on with my life. You know, I really began to wonder if I was safe or not. And I had been, you know, had several friends in the Las Vegas area. And, you know, I'm sure at that time, from their perception, things were strange with me. I couldn't talk about much. You know, I disappear at strange hours and stuff like that. And what I wanted to do, in case something unusual did happen to me, I just wanted these guys at least to know what was going on, what I was involved in. And since I had the test flight schedule, you know, virtually all the tests of the sport model, that's when I decided, you know, to tell Gene, John, my wife, what was going on, and, you know, her sister, I think, was the one other person that came with us. Oh, Jim Taliani.
Jim Taliani.
Yeah, and, you know, and it take them down on one of the nights when I knew the test flights were taking place, and, you know, to show them what was going on, what I was involved in, and say, look, if I suddenly disappear or something happens to me, just so you guys know, this is what was going on. So that was really the impetus for, you know, letting everybody know. John Lear was kind of a slightly different one. It was because, you know, I just wanted to tell the guy that all his work wasn't in vain, that, you know, there really was something like that going on at the test site.
It's one of the parts that I think is most important about the story, and yet it's the hardest to tell. The kinds of things that were going on in your lives and mine, being followed around, people listening to the phones, following you wherever you go, threats. I mean, it's hard to convey that, Gene, but it's real, and it happened. And it's in fact, the reason that Bob, the things came tumbling down for him was a very personal and painful reason. It's not the kind of thing you'd like to make up if you're making up a UFO story.
So you want me to say what it is? Is that what
if you want? Sure.
Well, when Bob was in the program and they were doing all the security checks, they had his phone tapped, and they were listening on his phone. Well, as bad luck would have it, Bob's wife was having an extramarital affair. And, of course, Bob didn't know it, but the guys listening on his phone line did, because they would hear her talking with whomever she was associated with. So they knew that sooner or later when he found out he was going to be emotionally distraught. And of course, you have to be emotionally balanced, psychologically balanced, to have that security clearance. And so they knew that this is what he was going to be up against. And so finally, his wife told him. And I even think that, I don't know, maybe Bob can straighten us out on this. I don't even know if maybe when we were taken out there to see the test of the disc, he took his wife out there just to, I don't know, to impress her or to reclaim her or whatever. I was a pretty new friend of Bob's at the time. He had other much older friends he knew much better, and I felt fortunate. I was thankful to be included in the crew that got taken out there to see the disc test. But anyway, long story short, she eventually told Bob, and after they heard on the phone, she had called her mother and told her mother that she had told Bob, and now they knew that Bob knew. And so when Bob, I guess one thing we haven't said yet is one of the nights we went out there to see the disc test, we had been pulled over by the Wacken Hot guards out there, the security guys. And when we knew that was going to happen, Bob got out of the car and went running across the desert because he didn't want to get caught out there with us. And so they stopped us and checked our IDs and asked what we were doing there. And we said we were just watching the stars. And they said, well, the stars look just the same from up on the highway, so go up there. So we went up there, and we picked up Bob again. And then we pulled out on the highway, and the county sheriff pulled us over out there and said, I've got a problem. When the Wacken Hot guards pulled this car over, there were 4 people in it, and now when I pulled over, there's 5 people in it. Can you explain that to me? And we stayed silent. So he detained us for about an hour and let us go. And the next day, Bob got a call. In fact, he reported to work at EG&G, thinking he was going back out to Area 51, but instead, Dennis, his security shadow, said, we're going to be going this way tonight, and they took Bob's car, if I remember correctly, and went out to Indian Springs Air Force Base, where they debriefed him and said, you know, we know about your wife, and under the circumstances, we're happy to be the ones to tell you, and your security clearance is temporarily revoked, and we'll let you know how things are going to transpire in the future. Isn't that in a nutshell, Bob?
Yeah, just to correct, a couple things is that when Tracy went with us out there in the motorhome, I didn't know about the affair at that time.
Right.
And then I don't quite remember what trip. Last trip when we went out there and we were standing out in the dark, and it was so incredibly dark, not, 30 feet in front of us. The whole Wacken Hut team was standing there looking at us in night vision scopes. Was that the last time we were there? I guess that makes sense. I guess the dates and times confused.
Well, I raised the issue with Tracy, your wife, because I think it's not the kind of, if you're going to make up a UFO story, that's not the kind of detail a man includes in their fanciful tale that they make up, is that their wife was having an affair. It's not something you would want spread out there, but you told the story, and I think it adds credibility. The other thing that people, it's hard to convey, Bob, is the kinds of things that were going on in your life. They were making your life miserable. Once they figured out you were telling people about this, there were threats, there were break-ins, there was a lot of bad stuff going on, right?
Yeah, it really got crazy, and I was really, to put it mildly, stressed out at that time. But I even went, I was walking around with an Uzi submachine gun in my car. And, I went to, I was going to a health club at night with a friend of mine named Mario. And, we drove, it was close to my house. We both were going there at the same time. We took my car, and I left my wallet and machine gun in the car. And I had been discussing this with Mario about being followed constantly, and we were making light of it. So when we got out of the car, we said, okay, let's check our doors and make sure everything's closed so the spies don't get us. And so we pulled on the doors, checked everything was locked, and went in. And when we came out again, we were just making light of it to try and bring a little relief to the situation. And when we come out of the health club about an hour later, both doors on the car are open. The wallet and machine gun are in plain view, and nobody was around. You know, obviously, if it was just a thief or something, they would have grabbed both the wallet and, you know, and weapon. You know, so it was just, in my opinion, just their way of saying, look, you know, at any time we can get into what you're doing. We're following you around even when you're, you know, you don't know it. And it was really terrifying. I mean, it's easy to talk about now, but it was, that was really a rough time.
Well, I can remember it. I mean, I was on the fringes of the story and would get these calls from you at night, and or we would meet somewhere, have a bite to eat or a cocktail or something, and come to find out we were being followed at that time. I had six different people who called me offering to give me information after the first interview, the Dennis interview, as part of a large project we're doing about UFOs. Six people in a row who were visited by people from different agencies who threatened them, who told them to keep quiet. And these were people didn't know each other. They had just talked to me on the phone. It was real. It was really going on. And then, you know, some of the guys who were following us years after they got out and were no longer working for Wackenhut or the military told us that that was part of their job, was to follow us around and see who we're talking to. So it's infuriating. You know, now we take for granted that our phones are listened to all the time by the NSA or whomever. But back then, we still valued our constitutional rights and privacy, and I certainly resented it. It's hard to convey that, though, to people, to let them know that it was real, but it sure was real then.
You really had to be there. You really did. It was...
George, I have a couple of classic Bob Lazar stories. I don't know what kind of time we have.
We got about 2 minutes before our break.
Okay, well, here's one that when Bob was in the program, there were some Russian agents in the Las Vegas area trying to approach people who worked in the program at S4 to bribe them or whatever. And because of this, they wanted the people that worked at S4 to carry weapons from their homes to EG&G and from EG&G home. And so when they put Bob up there at EG&G, we're going to issue him a weapon. And it was like a little, I don't know, 25 or 32 caliber. And they told him that they were going to issue it to him, and that if he lost it, it was going to be $500 was what it was going to cost. And Bob goes, well, this gun is even worth $500. Why would I pay $500 if I lost it? And I just think it's a classic that here's a guy working on the hardware from another star system. The Russians are chasing people around trying to bribe them or abduct them or whatever, and Bob is arguing about the deposit on the gun.
Well, if they had only known what kind of firepower you have at home and that you carry on a regular basis.
Well, he did. he said, why can't I use my own guns? And Dennis, his security shadow, said that he didn't know he had any. And Bob said, I've got a .44 Magnum and an Uzi, and I think even some of a little pistol. And then Dennis realized that because Bob was from New Mexico, they didn't require registration down there, so they took him over to the substation on St. Louis Avenue here in town and registered Bob's weapon.
Of course, since the story came out, all kinds of other people have come forward. And I have more than two dozen people who've worked at the base at different times who've told me bits and pieces of the story to corroborate what Bob says. But you've had other people that our audience, if you've followed the story, know they've come forward as these UFO messiahs telling their own stories about being at Area 51. And most of them are full of baloney. I mean, Dan Crane, Dan Burrish comes to mind, a couple of other people who I put them in sort of the gray basket. Bill Uhouse is somebody that I think was a pretty interesting source. When we come back, I want to talk about latest developments in the Area 51 story. A scientist who came forward named Boyd Bushman, who was a real guy who told an incredible tale. Going into the break with the Pixies, a song called The Happening about Area 51. Much more to come. Stay with us.